once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I realize we didn't do a disclosure in the first hour.
Right. So we should disclose now.
Those are cats dancing on snare drums in the Houston area. Anyway, the disclosure is that The Personal Wealth Coach is not just a premier AM radio Saturday morning Temple, Texas radio program. It's also a investment advisory firm, fee-only fiduciary type, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which doesn't mean anything except that's who our supervisor is, and we have over $100 million under management. Other than that, it really doesn't mean anything. And we're based in Salado, Texas. And so now we have disclosed, and we've told you who our regulators are and who you can complain to if you think we're giving untoward advice or behaving in a fraudulent or inappropriate manner.
Right. Which we are going to do, as usual, our best to avoid and to point out when we hear other people doing it.
There was a commercial last hour that was, I'm just going to say it, was a lie. The guy said there's no risk. There is a risk. Secondly, what he's doing is...
Let me give a rundown. Right. Some people listen online. Other people listen to podcasts. So you don't hear the same commercials if you're listening real-time online. And you don't hear any commercials at all in the podcast. So what happened is there was a advertisement in the break that said, I lost my money in the stock market. Other people lost their money in the stock market. I have found a way that is risk-free. It took me 5 years of research to put money away that I could get my money out tax-free in retirement at no risk of the market. The market goes down, I don't have anything to worry about. So he said the word no risk in there three times that I caught. He said tax-free income in retirement. That tells me something. Last hour we were talking about the possible bubble in the insurance market. What it tells me is he was talking about insurance products.
Well, he was talking about specifically buying life insurance.
Right. And then using that life insurance as a retirement vehicle and making sure that it's not going to have the risk of the market. The problem is that it has the risks of the market in it, because the insurance company has to invest the money in order to give you those rates of return.
And this is something that people often overlook in the financial crisis of 2007 through 2009. Well, actually, what Ben Bernanke calls the panic of 2007 through 2009. The kingpin in that crisis.
This sounds like a comic book. I want to hear more.
Kingpin, meaning the thing that was the major triggering factor that turned what would otherwise have been a relatively minor financial issue into a potentially global meltdown of financial institutions, was AIG, which is a life insurance company.
And they weren't the only ones in trouble. A lot of life insurance companies were in trouble at that point.
Since then, a lot of life insurance companies have divested themselves of a lot of things, and quite a number of life insurance companies, if you look at, for instance, if you go out and look at the stock value of a typical stock life insurance company, you will find out that it peaked before the crisis and is now probably a tiny fraction of what it was. And there's a reason for that, and the reason is there's a lot of risk that those life insurance companies in 15 years won't exist. And they're the only life insurance companies are the only major depository institution. Depository meaning people deposit their money there, that are not backed by a chartered agency or insurance program or something.
At the federal level.
At the federal government level. They're simply not backed by them. They're backed by state insurance funds, but state insurance funds are what backed banks in the 1930s, and they quickly ran out of money and said, sorry, you get pennies back on the dollar.
Right, and the savings and loan crisis in the late 1990s, for those of you that remember that, that was also backed by the state area. So the bigger backer, the better as far as risk goes. Mm-hmm. We're not saying that we are big advocates of massive regulation. What we're advocates of is full disclosure so that you know the risks that you're taking. And if that requires someone to regulate it, to make people tell you that you're taking risks when you invest in certain areas, then we're for that kind of regulation. Secondly, if you're a regulator, if you're a regulated organization and you're making claims that you're not supposed to, for instance, risk-free, tax-free, all the things that they were saying there, there are methods of getting money out tax-free through taking loans on your own policy. Well, that I wouldn't consider taking a loan from your house as income. I wouldn't, and in certain circumstances, you can use it as income, but there are some, in a regulatory environment, that commercial would not have flown.
Had the fellow who's in there didn't mention life insurance. He's going through a loophole in the life insurance regulatory laws and rules.
Because he's not licensed. The people that he tells you to call are.
But there's no question what he's talking about. There's also no question that, very frankly, he's either extremely ignorant, which I doubt, or he's lying. And the reason I tell you that is tax-free income in retirement. No. It's not going to
Roth happen. IRA, maybe. If no, you've got a Roth IRA, that'll work, but not in this case.
But I'm talking about where he said that there's no risk.
Right.
And it's not in the stock market. So you basically turn your money over to a life insurance company. You encounter a 15-year surrender charge and uncertain costs going into the future, and I can tell you that the costs are going to be relatively high. And if we have stable interest rates where they are today, over the next 15 years, then I can tell you that the costs in the life insurance will exceed the interest paid by the life insurance company, so you will have less money than you put in. Now, that's number one. Number two, I can also tell you that in a fixed life insurance policy, because it's not a security or he wouldn't be able to say those things, in a fixed life insurance policy, the portfolio that backs it is mostly bonds. And if you listened a little earlier, what we talked about with bonds is interest rates are at phenomenal low levels. When interest rates rise, and I say when, because either interest rates will rise from where they are today or the entire world economy will implode. Because negative interest rates cannot be sustained for an indefinite period of time. Either when interest rates rise, that bond portfolio is going to decay, and I strongly suspect we are going to see failures of life insurance companies at something like the level that we're seeing right now in the failure of oil companies.
And hedge fund companies over last year. So let me come at this from a different direction. I'm going to say something that's going to cause most of our listeners in the local area to think that suddenly I've come around to their way of thinking and that I'm a brilliant man.
You have, I'm sure. Yes.
And then I'm going to yank it all out from underneath them and they're going to hate me again. So the Affordable Care Act was one of the biggest wastes of time ever. See? Now everybody's going, well, he's come about to it. Like, the reason why isn't that the insurance laws were wrong or that they needed more understandability or we needed affordable care. It came about it the wrong way. Insurance companies are regulated by the state in which they abide. The resident state regulates the insurance company. But wait a minute, what about Blue Cross Blue Shield? What about AIG, what about Transamerica? You mean just go down MetLife, name any major insurance company, and they not only are a national company and offering insurance in each state, but they're also international and beginning to offer in lots of countries. Each of those insurance companies is regulated individually in 50 states, and some of those states, Louisiana and Florida, and particularly in Louisiana, it's by parish, and in Florida, it's by county. The county regulates the insurance code. So think of the complexity there. That you were talking about artificially low interest rates. Well, this is an artificially low profitability for insurance companies because they have to buy the time of attorneys in such massive quantities that it's staggering for them to release, in essence, the same plan in multiple states. They can't issue the same plan in every state because it's going to have modifications. And if you read the insurance booklet that you're given, you'll find things at the bottom not to be offered in, and then a long list of states that they're not supposed to go to. The problem with the insurance laws right now is they're written for a time when the largest insurance company was based in one state and maybe did some international trade, like insured a ship that was going from Boston to London. This, or insured a bunch of people in Boston for their lives. Now we have a company that stretches across many states that is now, in essence, they have to have a different company in every state that is owned by the company so that they can be regulated individually in that state, because the Constitution says that, and this is a very important feature of the Constitution, that the federal government is not allowed to regulate trade that only takes place inside a state. It's allowed to regulate interstate trade and no more. So this is why the interstate highway system is run by the government, by the federal government, and so on. So when you're talking about insurance code, as long as each state regulates itself and the states don't want to give that up, we have a problem in that a company could be completely unstable and be doing risky things in all the states, but there's no single authority that could point at them and say, hey, you're doing this wrong.
Oh, yeah, the state insurance commissioner could, but they don't have the resources to do it.
Exactly. And in cases where the state insurance commission has a budget of, you know, give a random...
A few million dollars. A
couple of million dollars. The state insurance company is making billions of dollars because they have a backer that's an international company. So if you think that there's some corruption in D.C., when it comes to insurance and how they're regulated, it's so different in every state that there has to be corruption somewhere.
Well, it's suffice to say that this is Jeff speaking. It's my hypothesis that the next financial meltdown, the next financial crisis will originate, based on history, in the life insurance companies.
That's where it started the last time. AIG was the first company that needed to be bailed out.
No,
they were bailed out by the
no.
New York Fed.
No, Bear Stearns was bailed out, and there's a lot of companies. But it was the one, the trigger. Because what happens is if you have a bank or even a bank holding company, there were existing laws that enabled the Federal Reserve to step in and give them money. To keep them from collapsing. Now, Lehman, unfortunately, the laws didn't apply to them because they simply didn't have enough assets. The Federal Reserve can only loan money to a company if it have assets. But there was no authorization other than a peculiar little side note to the Federal Reserve Act of 1918 that allowed the Federal Reserve to step in and, in essence, rescue twice AIG. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury together, if it wasn't for the TARP bill, which we don't have anymore, AIG would have failed, and had AIG failed, the world financial system would have gone down. And it's a life insurance company, and it's regulated by a state. And the end result is that we really haven't completely fixed that. We moved a long ways towards fixing it under Dodd-Frank, where it said that there's a financial stabilization board in Washington, D.C., that could designate companies that were so big that they were systemically important to the economy and put them under Federal Reserve regulation and supervision. Well, MetLife sued last week, week before last.
That said, don't fall under that.
And the judge said it's just arbitrary, therefore you're no longer under federal supervision. Now, the Treasury said they're going to appeal it.
That's
going to
get appealed, and hopefully the law will prevail here, because they are large enough that they are too big to fail.
But if they are successful in getting out from under Federal Reserve supervision, then what that says is no matter how big a life insurance company gets, nobody is going to be able to supervise it, and they can just go do what they want to
do. And as a side note, the thing that they're being required to do that they're upset about is maintain a higher reserve value for the debts that they may have to pay. And in the case of an insurance company, their debt would be in the event that you have a loss and they have to pay you. Mm-hmm. So they need to have reserves on hand to pay that. And the bigger they are, the more that important that is, because if a lot of people have problems at the same time, say three or four hurricanes and earthquake, and we've got issues, and I'm using those as a loose type of
thing. But life insurance
companies
are not affected by hurricanes and earthquakes.
Right. So this, not life insurance companies, but Met would be, because they offer other types of insurance.
Right, it's the life insurance side of things that are the risk. And the risk there, for example, the Federal Reserve comes in one of the stress tests recently and said, what happens if the Eurozone breaks up and the Euro collapses? What would happen to your finances, and could you cover it? That's the biggie.
Right.
And MetLife has to have enough reserves that if they run that scenario through, that Greece defaults and everybody runs and the British leave the Euro, and as a result, the entire Eurozone breaks up and everybody goes back to their local currency, and the chaos that ensues from that, if it's a large, systemically important, too big to fail, in essence,
right,
company.
One that their failure would impact the entire economy, right, in a big way.
Then these financial stresses, the company would tear the company apart unless it has enough reserve. And here's the key. It's not just MetLife failing that we're concerned about. What we're concerned about is the fact that all the money that other people have loaned, and these companies have huge loans from banks and from other insurance companies and from who knows where else in the economy.
If you have a stable value fund in your 401k, it is based on loans between insurance companies,
right,
being made by you to insurance companies.
So there's a risk there. And I don't think the law or the rules completely addressed it. They did address it. Says if the company gets big enough to be a systemic risk, then we need to take care of it. But MetLife just sued, and on the initial federal judge decision, negated the supervision of insurance companies by the Federal Reserve.
Now, for exactly the thing that we were talking about there, in that it is not they're not performing interstate trade. They're performing trade inside a state, so why does the federal government get to regulate them? And the federal government, there's a law that was passed, and the federal government says, well, we're allowed to regulate them if their failure would impact interstate trade in a big enough way. And there's some limits set in there. They have to impact the interstate trade on a level that's large enough. So once that hits to an appeals court, we're going to figure out what's supposed to happen. Now, we can go kind of, let me reel backwards something. In the 1930s and 40s, trying to figure out how to issue stock for a company fell in the same pattern and category as insurance companies, in that each state had their own completely different laws on issuing stock from your company. We still do, if you think about it. If you have an LLC in Texas, it's different than one in Delaware. But if you want to sell your company to somebody in Delaware, there are laws that both Delaware and Texas agree to, and those are called the Blue Sky Laws, that you're not allowed to sell 140% of your business if you're saying it's only 100% of your business. You're not allowed to do those things that we would consider fraud today that were kind of common practice leading up to the Great Depression. So the Blue Sky Laws happened because each state individually passed a law that looked very similar to every other state's version of that law, so that they could talk to each other with the same book in front of them and know what they were talking about. Insurance needs that, and I don't think it's going to happen. This is the thing that the Affordable Care Act should have focused on, is getting the states together to work together to make their own laws, or changing the Constitution to allow insurance companies to be regulated. So those are the things. Either way, what's happening now with the Affordable Care Act is, in some ways, it's overreaching its authority. It's being determined still. There are still court cases out there against the Affordable Care Act that are challenging whether or not they even have the authority to regulate insurance at a state level.
Well, to change the subject, first off, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join with us in this conversation. But I'd also like to change the subject.
I have a different subject as well, so you go first.
Peabody Energy filed for Chapter 11 last week.
Yes.
This week. And that's...
That's bankruptcy.
That is... Peabody Energy is 183 years old.
Well, that's probably... They're just not as spry as they used to
be. Well, and
it's
this
hard
is
to
the
get
point,
around when you're that
and here's
old.
The point I want to make that I think is really, really important to get our minds around. At the end of 2014, beginning January 1st, 2015, Peabody Energy was trading at $116 a share. That was a year and 3.5 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was trading at 74 cents a share if you could find somebody to buy it.
As of Friday.
As of Friday. At the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, Peabody Energy was highly recommended by a lot of analysts for being a very stable source of dividend income. It was a very profitable company.
We should tell them what they do.
Well, Peabody Energy was the largest private, meaning it's traded on the exchange, coal manufacturing company in the world. And the issue is that despite the fact that once 60%, then 50%, now 33% of the electricity in the United States is generated by coal, so you've got this huge volume of coal that needs to be mined and needs to be used every year. And Peabody looked like they had their act completely together, and within a year's time, they deteriorated from being one of the most stable, dependable sources of income in the United States to bankruptcy. And that is something that, and there's no evidence of fraud.
No, it's new technology coming.
It is
natural gas and
it really boiled down to the fact that the fracking, a combination of two things, fracking and a general change in public interest. The general change, basically,
opinions have changed.
One of the things that killed them was the breaking of a couple of dams. And they were basically temporary dams that were set up where they had some highly polluted water that had come out of coal mines.
You could have made this a lot more fun by just saying those damn things killed them.
Right. And as a result, they had two events where they basically flooded river valleys with poison.
Yes. There's arsenic and heavy metal, mercury, lead, all kinds of stuff in coal that you don't want in the water.
That's one of the things that the somebody that invested a little over a year ago in Peabody and said, okay, I'm really tired of getting low interest. Peabody was paying, I think, a 2.7-something% dividend at that point. And said, I can get a steady dividend of 2.7-something% if I put my money into Peabody. And they considered probably that there was no risk, any significant risk in that decision. And they just left it there. And they lost their money. And that's not the only company. By the way, Goodrich Oil, Goodrich Petroleum, which is was related to the Goodrich Tire Company. It's not anymore, but it was related to the Goodrich Tire Company. Filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, a series of investment funds that were private offerings over the last several weeks, one after another, have filed for bankruptcy. And if you happen to be one of the people who bought an interest in one of those investment funds in the peak of the oil deal, thinking this is a good source of interest, this is a good source of income because oil, everybody will always need oil, you are one of those people who saw your money disappear. This is one of the things that I think we need to pay very careful attention to, and that is just a couple of years ago, oil was a sure thing. People will always need, I heard the argument, people will always need oil. They will always need fuel. No, actually, they may not. Technology is changing, and to give you an example, there's a lot of money recently been pouring into oil companies. I don't know if you knew that.
Pouring into them.
What happens is, by the way, when these partnerships and so on, when these oil companies are failing, a lot of times in bankruptcy, their creditors, including a lot of limited partnerships and hedge funds, are taking equity in exchange for the money that was owed, so they wind up owning the company. And by the way, companies have a tremendous habit right now, a very consistent habit of failing a couple of years later again, because hedge fund managers don't do a particular good job of running oil companies.
In fact, they're just trying to get all of the money that's available out as soon as they possibly can, which is not good for the business.
And one of the things worth thinking about, and I'll turn it over to Jake here for his soapbox in just a minute. One of the things worth thinking about, and I do a lot of this, is think about the effect of driverless cars. And I don't know if you've seen the artist concept of the Apple car recently out. One of the things that strikes me about that particular vehicle is it's not going to use a lot of gasoline.
The Tesla's already, in certain circumstances, capable of being driverless.
Right.
And doesn't use any gas.
So we see something coming down the road, and there's things that you see, warning flags, you see these signs. But it's good to think about it. For example, we were talking about insurance companies a minute ago.
Right.
And we talk about property casualty insurance companies, which MetLife also has property and casualty. What happens when automobiles stop having accidents?
The insurance rates are going to drop. The profit that they're making from calculating how much that you should pay them for insurance is going to drop drastically too, but because then, the cars aren't going to be banging into each other.
What happens to all the insurance agents?
What happened to the mortgage agents that were out there selling mortgages before the Great Recession? They're going to change jobs.
What happened to the travel agents? What happened? So one of the things that we see coming in the near future at the Personal Wealth Coach, and we think about a lot, is that there are technological changes like fracking. Nobody expected, I really don't think a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago for sure, nobody expected fracking to cause Peabody Coal to go out of business. Matter of fact, people still didn't believe in fracking 3 years ago.
What's more, fracking was not a single company going, we have discovered a profitable way to get oil out of shale. It was hundreds of different companies using different techniques with patents. So it was a wave of new technology. Each of those different methods can be combined, and they're still working on getting the most efficient methodology out of there. And that's the methodology out of there. And that's one of the things that I was going to say as well, is that as these big companies, some of them are going bankrupt. It's more the little companies. They're being purchased by bigger companies. That part of the reason they're purchasing them isn't for their oil rights, it's for their intellectual property rights on the patents that they hold for the way that they're doing fracking. Because once you own multiples, you can start combining them and create new patents out of that, a more efficient way of getting the oil out. And that's what's happening now in the consolidation. So that wasn't my soapbox, but it's kind of a wrap-up to this. No single company said fracking is going to change the world in the next year, because each of them thought, by the time I get big enough for fracking to change the world, it'll be decades from now. Each of them thought they were doing it individually, and then there was a big race when everybody realized everybody else was doing it. And that's why we had the drop in prices that we
had. By the way, one of the things to pay attention to, and one of the reasons that you see the market moving with the price of oil, there's a graphic in the Wall Street Journal today that's really, you have to hunt for it. It's only online. It's not in the paper. U.S. shale, it costs about $23 per barrel to get the stuff out of the ground and to the refinery. For regular normal oil in the United States, it costs about $22 a barrel.
So now it's just $1 more expensive to frack than to get normal oil.
In the United Kingdom, which is the offshore Brent oil fields, it costs about $44 a barrel to get it out of the ground and to the refinery.
Because the ground has water between it and the pumper.
And we closed out, Brent closed out at about $43 a barrel at the end of the week, which meant in the United Kingdom, the oil companies are losing money on every barrel they pull out from the North Sea. On the other hand, in Saudi Arabia, it costs about $8 a barrel to get the stuff out of the ground and to the refinery.
Except that they have a bunch of entitlement expenses that go on top of that income.
But that's the actual cost of getting them, in other words, right. Saudi Arabia can afford to pull oil out of the ground consistently with no problem at all at $15 a barrel or $20 a barrel. At $20 a barrel, across the board in the United States, the oil, it costs more to get it out of the ground than it does than they make.
Right.
And so that's why $40 a barrel, the market goes up. If the price moves down towards $20 a barrel, the market goes down because there's a lot of companies that have a lot of interest in oil, and they're concerned about seeing a collapse of the oil industry. Anyway.
Okay. Now, since we've covered one macro issue, we're going to cover another one.
Okay.
I'm going to start with a micro.
So this is a micro-macro?
It's a micro that became a macro.
Okay.
Not that long ago.
Sounds like algae.
2 years ago, Portland, Oregon, changed their minimum wage laws.
Mm-hmm. Yes, $15.
$15 an hour.
$15 a barrel, right.
Right, a barrel. Right. $15 an hour. And in doing so, the rest of Oregon didn't change their law at the same time. So we were able to look, as economists do, in a very rational and unemotional way at the jobs leaving Portland and the jobs growing outside of Portland in Oregon.
This did look like microbes.
Yeah, they were. It was like, it's all on a spreadsheet.
You can see them going down the highway, right.
But if you make a heat map and you show little pinpricks of new jobs being made and going away, you see this outflow from the city, which had just raised its minimum wage. It's the first place where McDonald's started, not on a temporary basis, putting in kiosks in their restaurants. Because it costs too much money to pay the people behind the counter $15 an hour if they don't want to raise the prices on their food too much. Because if they raise the prices on their food too much, you're not going to buy it there. You're going to go out of town to buy it. McDonald's is, I want the same menu and pretty close to the same price no matter where I go. And if their prices are a lot higher, people won't eat there. So we saw this mass outflow of low-paying jobs from Portland into the rest of Oregon. And we saw businesses closing up in Portland and moving outside of Portland to do things that require minimum wage. Well, this week, California just passed a minimum wage law that brings the price per hour up to $15 for the whole state. And it's already begun. American Apparel is closing its LA facility because they can't afford it. Now, something to know about American Apparel. They have been proud for many years at paying their workers more than minimum wage. They said that they are paying a higher market wage, and they have asked that other companies do the same. They have created high-quality products, and now they're at least in L.A. leaving to go somewhere else. The L.A. law means that the minimum wage is going to come sooner. The $15 an hour isn't going to actually hit the whole state until 2022, but the exodus has begun, and it's a very simple thing here. We were talking about driverless cars. We're right on the cusp of having a bunch of robots being able to take these jobs very quickly and do the American Apparel jobs for the people, and you don't have to pay them minimum wage. You don't have to pay them $15 an hour. And the savings there are about to be tremendous, which means in an effort to give more money to the underpaid, we're taking the jobs from the underpaid completely. Because if somebody's living in LA, and right now they've been thinking, I've got a great job at American Apparel. I hopefully will be able to use this job to get a better education. They're paying me more than the minimum wage I would be able to get just down the road doing manual labor. So I'm going to get myself an education, and from there I'm going to get a higher paying job. Well, now those people don't have jobs. And this is something that's across the board. If you raise the mandatory price of something, everything that depends on that something's price is going to go up too. This is not a theory. This is not a maybe. It's what happens, because if I'm selling somebody an apple for 50 cents and it costs me 25 cents to grow the apple, and I don't have competition, If it suddenly costs me 30 cents to grow the apple, I'm not going to leave the price at 50 cents when I sell it. I'm going to make it 60 cents. That is just the way we do business. It is across the board in every direction. People don't eat their own costs forever because they're taking a pay cut. And then when they take a pay cut, they want to say this is a temporary thing. I either need to sell a lot more apples, which in this case is not easy to do, or I need to raise the price. The prices get raised. Raise the minimum wage, and this may be in some ways a good thing for inflation. We're not seeing enough inflation now. We need to see a little bit of inflation. We're seeing some deflation. But what this is going to do... Go ahead.
When did Portland raise their minimum wage?
A couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, something like that.
Oregon just starting this year is raising it to $15.
Yeah, Oregon, yeah, I said they did it before the state did. So there was a year and a half or so that we could look at the two and see the transition. Now Oregon as a state has raised its rates.
So basically,
the West Coast has raised its rates, which means if they're doing business in Oklahoma with products that they're making in Oregon or California, they're going to have to raise their prices in Oklahoma. And that means that the people in Oklahoma just got a benefit in that if they want to start a business and do the things that American Apparel were doing, it's a big, big start, but they can do it at a lower price.
So what happened to the unemployment rate in Portland over the last 2 years?
The unemployment rate in Portland is actually down. They are getting more jobs there, but they're higher paying jobs. The lower paying unemployment is up.
So
the people in the lower paying jobs, the ones that this was supposed to help, lost jobs.
I read an article on that seemed to me, by the way, it's still 9%, which is certainly higher than it is in Texas.
Right, a lot higher than Texas. And it's probably going to go higher still after the minimum wage.
It's consistent with what Oregon and Washington State and to some degree California have been trying to do.
Fall off the map?
No.
Get rid
of the poor people.
Right. No, export the poor people.
Now, I don't know if it's intentional.
They sure seem to be working hard in that direction.
But the end result is that what I just read an article on what happened in Portland and what is already starting to happen in Oregon because it's going into effect, and they expect to happen. The economists expect to happen in California, and of course, there's a lot of people with an axe to grind. There's the people on the right who say, "Oh, this is horrible. This is terrible,"
and the people on the left say, "No, this is great,
wonderful, and it's great."
The reality is somewhere in the middle.
Well, the actual effect, as far as I could tell, in Portland was that you had a lot of low-income people, low-education people.
Leave. Yeah.
And you had higher-educated people filling the slots that were left. For instance, restaurant workers in the Portland area, about 50% of them technically are at a minimum wage.
Right.
And the end result is that apparently we now have a better educated set of restaurant workers in Portland than we do in other places.
Yeah, you can have a philosophical conversation with your waiter at the local restaurant because they're more educated.
So what it's the end result is apparently. And I'm not trying to judge this in any way. The end result is sort of simply you Austinify, and Austinify, I mean,
it wouldn't
surprise
me.
I use because
it wouldn't surprise me if they raised the minimum wage in Austin too. Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
East Austin, for example, used to be poor people.
Yeah, and little houses, and now they're very cheap little houses. Now they're really expensive little houses. Same houses,
really expensive, and more wealthy people are coming in and buying the houses. In many cases, tearing them down and building new houses. But the point is that the poor people are exiting Austin so that ultimately Austin winds up with a higher IQ, a higher education level, and people who get along very, very well because they're all of the same education level and are making more money.
Yes, but you're losing some of the demographic makeup. There's a lot more white people than they're used to as a percentage in Austin, and this is the opposite of what they were claiming they wanted to do. Now, on a good side of that, the benefit to the people, East Austin is a really, really good example of that. It's traditionally a black area, African American. It was a segregated city for a very long time, purely segregated based on this up and down, you on this side to the east, that's black people, on this side to the west, is white people.
So if
and
you
it
were
hung around.
If you're northbound on I-35, you're more likely to be black. And if you were southbound on I-35, you're more likely to be white.
On average, yes.
Okay.
And this is something that, as Austin was a liberal bastion, this is something that they...
Well, some people would call it something else that starts with
maybe,
Bass.
Maybe yeah. not a... Maybe has some of the letters in it.
Yes, right.
Okay, exactly. Yeah. So this community, this large community that is Austin, decided that they wanted to do some things to help their population and so on. And what's happened is the cost of living has come up as they've attracted more and more people with tech and so on. Cost of living has come up. But that means that the people that were living in East Austin began to sell their homes to new people that were coming to town. And in the 1980s and 90s, this was the Hispanic community. So they came in and bought these traditionally African-American homes. The African-American people went north, in some cases south, but mostly north, up into Pflugerville and Round Rock, were able to buy larger houses and become part of a larger community, not segregated. And since then, the Hispanics are now moving north because highly educated white people with high income are buying up, they're calling it gentrification, are buying up East Austin. And the process is putting a lot of money into the pockets of people that were living in Austin before that have now migrated north mostly, and in the process of migrating have bought bigger houses with bigger yards, have the potential to have better education for their kids. And if you look back through the Boston history, if you look at East Coast history at migration patterns and you see these groups that have the slums that eventually get gentrified, but as they happen, it desegregates that population and it causes them to integrate into the rest of society. I mean, that's what happened to the Irish and to the Scottish who were considered low-level, nasty people, and they need to live all over there.
The Scots-Irish are.
Right, and it means that we have a radio program.
Right.
But when they integrated and picked up the culture and added to the culture and had it at a way that they were able to sell their home to the next set of people for a profit and then move out and get their own. Anyway, it's a good thing. It's a good pattern, but it's not something new. It's something that we expect to continue, and it's one of those things that it's predictable.
There's a new element to it, and I'll talk about that maybe after the commercials. But we do need to play commercials because Town Square Media owns KTEM. That's full disclosure.
Right.
And Town Square Media is a for-profit company and would like to remain in business. And somebody's got to pay for this show. And so they want us to play some commercials. So we're going to play some commercials, but we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And despite rumors to the contrary, we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And
or at least rumors about rumors. I heard a rumor that there are rumors about us not coming back.
That could be the rumors.
Maybe that I heard it from you.
20 years. You know, we're coming up on 20 years?
Yeah.
Do you guys, anybody been listening to us for 20 years? Oh, no.
No. They would be in a psychiatric institute by this point. This is not something you want to listen to for 20 years.
It's institution. It's not institute. Psychiatric institutes is where they teach psychiatrists. Well, maybe that's where
maybe
they went.
It's a learning facility.
Could be. It could be. Let's see. What the New York Public Employee Pension Fund is dumping their hedge funds.
Yes. CalPERS is discussing doing the same.
Because they've discovered something, and that is that hedge funds...
charge a lot of money for not doing very much.
They charge a lot of money, and lately they've been really, really good at losing money. Which, I don't know if that makes you feel any better. It makes me feel better, because we avoided the use of hedge funds when they were making, when they theoretically were making lots and lots and lots of money. Because we said, hey, you know...
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
We look at these charts and these long-term theories and how investments work, and their returns can't be real and they can't be sustained. You're going to lose all the money that you made and then some. And sure enough, it worked out that way. And please understand, I have great sympathy for the people who were sold on a sure thing and thought they were going to get a lot of money as long as they agreed not to take their money out or check the values. And again...
And I have a thing that this is one of my big factors that I throw in when we're talking about hedge funds. Hedge funds generally run on a principle, they call it 20 and 2, where they get 20% of the profits and 2% of the assets under management. That's their fees. But
so they get 2% whether they make money or not.
Right. They make 2% if they make money or not. But if they make money, they get 20% of it. The big thing that I have is if you're going to take 20% of the money if I make it, that's my money that you're taking, then if you lose money, you've got to give me 20% back. But they never agree to that. So, hey, I want 20% of the losses back out of your pocket if you're going to take 20% of the gains out of mine. But there are no hedge funds that do that for some reason.
I wonder why
that reason is.
There's just a rule, and if anybody's still listening at this point, there's a rule.
I stopped listening hours ago.
That I have found that works quite well. And that is, if somebody wants you to invest money and promises you either no losses or a high return, but the condition for that no loss or high return or a combination of the two is that you lose a great deal of liquidity or you lose a great deal of your ability to capture that profit for an extended period of time. For example, the non-traded real estate investment trusts that are still sold. The issue is that the company will buy back a few shares if they feel like it in any given year, but you can't depend on it. The salesman will tell you, oh, it's no problem. The company buys back the shares if you need the money.
Unless they don't.
It's the fact that they're non-traded means that, they don't go up and down. It makes you feel very comfortable because you don't see the market value going up and down. But that means that the first time that you would know that they're broke is when you receive a notice that they filed for bankruptcy. So one day it'd be kind of like Peabody. One day it's worth $116 a share, and the next day it's worth nothing. The other one that I really believe through hard experience that you should avoid is something that says, hey, we promise you won't lose money. We promise you have a lot of potential for making money.
Yeah, those two don't go together.
But if you
lose money and have potential to make money, those don't go together.
But if you try to get your money out, we will guarantee you that we'll charge you 15% to get your money back if you get there in time.
Right.
Now, that means the moment you put the money in,
you took
15% loss. And hopefully, what they're promising, in essence, is, and then we're talking about annuities here, and fixed life insurance policies. What they're promising is, over the next 15 years, we will allow you to take whatever money is in there out without charging you a big fee to take the money out.
To take your money out without charging you money.
Along the way, we promise we will charge you amount of money that probably would embarrass the hedge fund manager every year. And in 15 years, if there is a profit or if there's a loss, whatever, we won't charge you a visible fee to take your money out. Now, if somebody says, I want your money for 15 years.
And you can't have it back without paying me this huge percentage.
Yeah. And I promise you that 15 years from now, you will have at least a break even and maybe you'll make some money. I want you to think about that just a minute. There's something wrong with that. Anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with a personal.
You have
coach.
Seconds. Please make it quick.
Yeah. Could you put me back on hold, please?
Sure. Could we what? Okay. He's back on hold. Okay. So there's just a big deal here, okay? And we're out of time. This has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have live people during the week. Obviously, on the weekend, we don't have live people, so you have to talk to a voicemail. But it's 947-1111 locally.
You can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, listen to our podcasts, read our newsletters. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.